From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Yesterday, President Biden banned Russian energy imports, saying it would hurt Putin's war machine and drive up costs here in the United States. The average price of a gallon of gas today is $4.17. While Russia provides a very small amount of the crude oil used in the U.S., Europe is far more dependent on Russia for their energy needs, and Putin has threatened to cut them off. On the show today, can the West survive without Russian energy? What impact will this ban have on Putin's war, the U.S. and global economy? Will this crisis deepen our dependence on fossil fuels or jumpstart a boom in renewable energy? Our guests are Nico Savos from the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Megan O'Sullivan from Harvard University's Kennedy School. Join the conversation, and it all comes your way after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukrainian nuclear officials say the Chernobyl nuclear site is now running on backup diesel generators. Electrical power is out to the site, and workers cannot repair it because Russian troops have attacked. Experts say there is no immediate danger of a nuclear reactor meltdown. More than two dozen foreign policy experts have signed a letter calling for a limited no-fly zone over Ukraine. Evelyn Farkas is the former Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia under the Obama administration. She signed the letter saying Ukrainian civilians fleeing fighting through humanitarian corridors need to be protected.
If we want to let these starving, increasingly starving and desperate civilians in Ukraine live, we have to provide some kind of enforcement of any corridors that we agree to, because otherwise we're just setting the people up for basically being picked off by artillery and aircraft from the sky.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. But U.S. officials say setting up even a limited no-fly zone would widen the war in Ukraine. Russian President Putin says he would see it as an act of war by NATO. Israel says it will provide temporary refuge to 25,000 Ukrainian citizens. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem. Israel's prime minister continues mediation efforts with the leaders of Russia and Ukraine.
Some 2,000 Ukrainians were already in Israel prior to the war. 2,000 arrived since then. Israel says it will accept 3,000 more. These non-Jewish Ukrainians may work in Israel, but they must promise to leave when the war is over. At the same time, Israel is preparing for as many as 100,000 new immigrants from Ukraine and Russia, those who have Jewish family ties and qualify for Israeli citizenship. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett spoke again Tuesday with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and also with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Bennett met Putin at the Kremlin last week, the first leader to mediate with the Russian president in person since Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stocks opened sharply higher this morning as crude oil prices eased a bit. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped nearly 600 points in early trading.
The modest drop in crude oil prices has so far brought no relief at the gas pump. AAA says the average price of gasoline climbed to a new record high today, $4.25 a gallon. That's up 59 cents in just the last week. Diesel prices have jumped even more sharply, spiking 84 cents in the last week to a national average of $4.88 a gallon. President Biden says more price increases are likely as the U.S. and its allies seek to isolate Russia economically in response to its invasion of Ukraine. McDonald's, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, and other major corporations say they're suspending operations in Russia. Russia's stock market remains shuttered, and the Russian currency has lost about half its value. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up nearly 650 points. That's nearly 2%. This is NPR.
This is WHYY News. It's 10:04. Good morning. I'm Priyanka Tiwari in Philadelphia. U.S. farmers have reported seeing fertilizer prices rise as much as 300% over the last several months. That's according to a report from the American Farm Bureau Federation. And these price issues impact Pennsylvania, a state with over 52,000 farm operations. Bill Ziders is the spokesperson for the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau, and he points out that these pricing issues create uncertainty for the Commonwealth's farming businesses.
When those input costs spike very dramatically, you don't know if you're going to come out profitable at the end of the season.
Ziders explained that rising energy costs are playing a role in the increase in fertilizer costs. He also pointed out that Russia is one of the biggest exporters of components that make fertilizer, and the conflict it's waging in Ukraine is going to cause, quote, more of a shortage. And an effort to end Pennsylvania state-run liquor store monopoly is getting some opposition in Philadelphia. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
State Representative Natalie Mihalik of Western Pennsylvania wants to use a state constitutional amendment to do what legislation hasn't been able to do, end the state store system.
We've had this system in place for over 88 years now. There have been many attempts in the past to modernize the system, and politics gets in the way of progress. We have a bad habit of that in Pennsylvania, and I think this is, you know, a way to put the issue to bed once and for all.
Denise Brown is a single mother who works in the state store system and put her son through college because of the good-paying job. She says it gives her peace of mind.
Being with PLCB and us being with the union backing us, I can go to sleep easily and I can wake up and just know that I do have a job that next day.
The earliest the question could come before the voters is 2023, since the amendment has to be approved by the State House and Senate in two successive sessions. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
At 10:06, it's 39 degrees, raining and foggy in Philadelphia, our high only near 40. This is WHYY News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Appian. Appian offers a unified, low-code technology to help businesses stay ahead of change. More information is available at appian.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, President Biden announced the U.S. is banning all energy imports from Russia.
I'm announcing the United States is targeting the main artery of Russia's economy. We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine.
Russian energy imports are a small part of the energy we use here in the U.S., with just 3% from crude oil. You can't say the same thing about Europe. In 2021, Europe got 45% of its total gas imports from Russia. The European Commission announced plans yesterday to cut EU dependence on Russian gas by two-thirds by the end of the year. Prices at the pump are up dramatically here in the States, with the average price jumping from $3.62 to $4.17 a gallon in 1 week. That's according to AAA. And that's also more than 50 cents a gallon. Today on Radio Times, we talk about Russia's role as an energy provider, the political and environmental impact of energy dependence, plans to make up for the energy shortfall, including talks with Venezuela, the potential for renewables, and whether this ban will hurt Putin's war effort. And we have two guests. Nikos Savos is the James R. Schlesinger Chair in Energy and Geopolitics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Nikos Savos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us by Skype is Megan O'Sullivan. She's the Kirkpatrick Professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School. And Megan O'Sullivan, nice to have you with us on the show as well.
Very good to be with you, Marty.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Megan, but I want to hear from both of you. What is the significance of President Biden's announcement yesterday for the United States, but also for Russia?
Well, I think your program provided a perfect lead-in to this conversation, because the impact of the U.S. ban on importing Russian crude and product in itself would not be particularly significant for the U.S. economy or for Russia. As you mentioned, this trade is a very small portion of American consumption, and it is an even smaller portion of overall exports from Russia. That said, this is not something that's happening in a vacuum. This is happening in a context that it signals a whole range of things to markets, and it portends more action. And that's where I think we're going to see a lot more impact. So the fact that the U.S. banned this crude oil and product.
Right.
And you mentioned crude oil and product, which is distinct from what the EU made a pledge to do about natural gas.
Right.
And these are two very different markets, and they have very different impacts. So we'll have to talk a little bit about that. But I'll just say that what is really concerning me, or what I'm keeping my eye on, is if this is just the first step in a longer list of sanctions that will be announced in the coming days and weeks. And I think that's a dynamic that we've seen thus far in the last couple of weeks, that you know, sanctions or other actions that the West said they weren't going to take, they weren't going there, they weren't prepared to bear the cost, have suddenly become actually put in place because of the shock and horror of what is happening in Ukraine and because of Russian actions. So the fact that the EU is saying they're not going to ban the import of Russian oil right now is very significant. That would be a more disruptive effect on global markets. But we don't know. They're not banning it today, but could they ban it next week? That remains to be seen. Could the U.S. use secondary sanctions to try to move other countries to import similar, to execute similar bans? All of this, I think, is very much an open question. This is a very dynamic situation.
Indeed, and I want to pick up on all that. But, Nikos, let me get you in on the conversation. What are you then looking for? As Megan mentioned, this is really, you know, a small amount of imports that we get from Russia, so it may not have a huge impact on Russia or the United States. What are you looking for?
I totally agree with everything that Megan said. All I want to do is sort of emphasize where she ended, which is that this is an incredible acceleration of the response. We began this war in the first tranche of economic measures and sanctions on Russia, and from the beginning, we wanted to make sure that we didn't disrupt energy quite yet. And what you're seeing is that the public pressure, frankly, to do more is moving much faster than where the policy is. Mm-hmm. You're seeing polls in Europe saying we have to stop importing Russian energy. So even though the politicians are trying to figure out, you know, how do I win this war? How do I have sanctions that hurt Russia more than they hurt us? How do I manage this? How do I prepare? As Megan said, you know, this could drag out for a long time. You know, how do I put myself in the best position for the long haul? You know, that is the, if I can put it in quotes, rational way to wage war. But the images we're seeing, you know, the stories coming out of Ukraine, you know, that's mobilizing public opinion in a way where the demand for much harsher action is just incredibly loud. So what I'm looking at is how do you navigate that space between what voters are telling you, what the politics is pointing you towards, and what is sort of the sensible and best way to wage war. So I absolutely agree with Megan that, you know, we thought this was, you know, stage 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, it's come in the first 2 weeks, right? So that tells you how quickly things are moving. And all the things that we thought were never on the table, you know, banning Russian oil, banning Russian gas in Europe, all these things are now possible. And that puts us in an incredibly difficult situation analytically, because we have never really, really thought about how to handle these kind of scenarios, right? So we're in totally uncharted territory.
Well, and again, I want to pick up on all that. As I said, this is a very complicated issue. But let me just pick up, and if I can go back to you, Megan O'Sullivan, assuming that Europe takes some steps to cut its dependence on Russia for natural gas or for crude oil, how dependent is Russia on energy for its overall economy?
Russia is very, very dependent on these resources and the revenues generated from both oil and gas. The estimates vary, but some people say it makes up about half of Russia's budget. And a key thing to remember, again, is the difference between oil markets, which are global, and natural gas markets, which are, you know, where Russia is much more tightly connected to Europe, given infrastructure constraints and impediments. So I think and Russia makes a lot more of its money from oil than it does from natural gas. But keep in mind that Russia is also benefiting hugely from these increases in price because it, along with other oil and gas producers, it is raking in these high revenues, at least for the time being. So I think the implicit question behind your question is, you know, what would this mean for the Russian economy if the flow of oil and gas were severed for a variety of reasons. You know, Nikos mentioned some. It could come from the West. We saw yesterday that Russia's energy minister threatened, this is really the first time, you know, threatened that Russia could actually cut natural gas imports to or exports to Europe. And that could be very, very costly for the European economies as well as the Russian economies. But I think the Russian economy is going to be, I don't think devastated is actually too strong a word. This
really?
Is going to be, and we haven't ever seen anything like this. This is the 11th largest economy in the world. And we're moving in a direction where we could be in a few weeks that it is virtually, you know, severed from the West, where it does receive many, many of its revenues.
Well, picking up on that and going to you, Niko Savos, then, and we heard in President Biden's announcement yesterday that these sanctions are an effort to reduce and cut and affect Putin's war machine, quoting the president there. I mean, the goal is, with all these sanctions, is to essentially try to, bankrupt Russia so they can no longer wage a war in Ukraine. Does it work that way?
I think you're asking a really important question that I think we should spend some time on, which is, what are we trying to accomplish here? Right. Because I think, you know, all the literature on economic sanctions tells us that they can be effective if they have a very clear objective, usually if it's a limited objective, if you're just trying to change one or two things. And so one of the concerns, and Megan alluded to this, is that we're piling sanctions upon sanctions, and it's not obvious what the end game is, right? So if it's one thing to say, I want to impose incredible economic damage on the Russian economy, I want to wreck the Russian economy. Okay, but what is the impact of that in the war that's happening? I think we sort of assume that the money that we're sending to Russia to buy energy is sort of funding this war, and I put funding this war in quotes. And it's true in some ways. It's certainly true that over the last 20 years, the money that we sent to Russia helped fund this military. I'm not entirely sure that what is happening on the ground right now in Ukraine is dependent on this flow of money at this particular moment. So I think it's important to think through, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to change Putin's mind? Are we trying to cause a coup in Russia? Are we trying to cause a revolution in Russia? Are we just trying to degrade the ability of the Russian military to win in Ukraine? All these outcomes have different policy levers that we can deploy. So I think one of the conversations that we're going to be getting into is, you know, all these sanctions have a cost on us as well. Megan alluded to this. The prices are going crazy. We're paying for that. So the question is, can we design policies that hurt Russia more than they hurt us? And it seems that we're moving very quickly and without a very clear end goal in mind. So I'm not quite sure if we're drawing these links properly.
Well, picking up on that and going back to you, Margaret O'Sullivan, and we're almost up in a break here, but we're talking about, you know, a very interconnected economies when it comes to energy. And we're already seeing, you know, the price at the pump going up something like 50 cents or more than 50 cents in the last week. Can we punish Russia without hurting ourselves?
Well, the answer, as Niko suggested, is no. It's just a question of, what is the relative pain, and how much is the West willing to bear? But I want to point out a couple things. I know we're going to break. One is that this pain will not only be inflicted on the U.S. and Europe and Russia. This is going to have a huge impact on other countries around the world, and particularly developing nations, which are really going to feel the brunt of much higher oil prices, and, as your program suggested at the beginning, higher food prices, both because Russia and Ukraine are some of the largest exporters of wheat in the world, and because of the increase in fertilizer costs. So the impact of what we're seeing right now is going to cascade through the world, and it will have very significant economic and political consequences. If I have time to underscore one quick thing that Niko said, which I think is
just
very
quickly,
important,
yep.
This question of, you know, when do sanctions work? And it's true, it's when they have clear objectives. And right now, I think the intention is to try to dissuade Putin to change his behavior in the conflict. But there are some confused signals with the sanctions regime. We've sanctioned Putin personally. That usually suggests that we have no intention of interacting with him in the near future. And certainly the economic disengagement suggests that. So it wouldn't be It wouldn't be crazy for Putin to think this is a regime change strategy, which makes it highly unlikely that economic pressure will result in a change in strategy.
Well, we're going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the Sandy Hook tragedy and the battle for truth. We'll talk with Elizabeth Williamson, whose new book is about the torment conspiracy theorists who claim the shootings were a hoax inflicted on Sandy Hook parents. Some were stalked and driven into hiding. She also describes how they fought back, including with successful lawsuits against Alex Jones. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Foundation for Delaware County. You and your financial advisor can learn how to partner with the foundation to help meet your philanthropic goals through a donor-advised fund, gift annuity, or estate planning. Learn more at delcofoundation.org.
I'm Scott Tong. The new animated film Turning Red follows a 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl who becomes a giant red panda when she's emotional.
I just felt like the animal itself is just the perfect metaphor for puberty. You know, it's like awkward and hairy, and the color red is just reminiscent of anger, of embarrassment.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Weekdays at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Great Books Summer Camp, where readers, thinkers, and leaders in middle and high school explore literature and build critical thinking skills. On campus this summer at Haverford and Stanford. Writers' workshops, too. More at greatbookscamp.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Oil prices have reached a 14-year high. Gas prices in the U.S. are over $4 a gallon and climbing. Today in Radio Times, how can the West reduce dependence on Russian energy? Will sanctions on Russian oil and gas halt the war in Ukraine? Talking with Nikos Savos. He is the James R. Schlesinger Chair in Energy and Geopolitics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Megan O'Sullivan, Kirkpatrick Professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School. Let me play a clip, and this is actually President Ronald Reagan. It's 1982. It's an address to the nation on East-West trade relations, and it comes courtesy of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and this is, of course, in the middle of the Cold War.
The Soviet Union faces serious economic problems, but we, and I mean all of the nations of the free world, have helped the Soviets avoid some hard economic choices by providing preferential terms of trade, by allowing them to acquire militarily relevant technology, and by providing them a market for their energy resources, even though this creates an excessive dependence on them. By giving such preferential treatment, we've added to our own problems, creating a situation where we have to spend more money on our own defense to keep up with Soviet capabilities, which we helped create.
To you, Nikos, I mean, it seems that looking back over our history of oil and gas production and imports, that we have had to rely on dictators, on autocrats, whether in the Middle East or in Russia or, you know, in places like Venezuela, in order to get a lot of our energy.
You're absolutely right. Geology is unforgiving. Geology is where it is. And so we have seen countries in the West, China today, you know, you have to go and buy oil or gas wherever oil and gas exists. And I think, you know, listening to that clip, I think part of it underscores just the difficulty of disentangling this relationship. I mean, it's very easy for a president to come up and say, I want to no longer depend on Middle Eastern oil or Russian gas. The reality is that there is a really strong economic logic to this trade, which is why, you know, Ronald Reagan's speech came at a time when the U.S. was imposing sanctions to stop Russia, stop the Soviet Union from selling additional gas to Europe, and those sanctions failed. Europe went ahead and continued to buy Soviet natural gas. So I think what you're dealing with is the reality of just where the energy market is. I think the challenge has been that throughout the Cold War and up until 2 weeks ago, Europe understood the difficulty of this dependence, but it thought it could manage it. It thought that, you know what, there's a certain boundary of behavior, and as long as we play within this box, we can deal with this dependence on Russia. That assumption, which has guided European purchases from the Soviet Union and then from Russia for the better part of 60 years, has been totally upended in the last 2 weeks.
I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes, Megan O'Sullivan. When we talk, though, about the global marketplace when it comes to oil, is there such a thing as Russian oil over here, American oil over there, Venezuelan oil over there, or is it all, in the final analysis, all mixed up together?
I think at a high level, Marty, I always use this analogy, which is sort of unpleasant, but it catalyzes the mind to think this way. It's like a global bathtub of oil with everybody dumping in their oil and pulling out oil, and it's hard to know exactly where everything came from. There is a global market for oil. Of course, there are at a lower level, there are issues about refining and crude capacities and capabilities and qualities that affect the flow of trade. But it is a global market, which is very different, as I said earlier, to natural gas. And when the Europeans talk about cutting off of oil, you know, that would be a huge disruption. But again, the big question would be, is Russia able to take that oil that was going to the United States, that was going to the UK and to potentially the rest of Europe — that decision hasn't been made at this point — and is it able to sell it elsewhere? And that would, you know, it would get into the bathtub through a different straw, a different direction. But the consequences wouldn't be zero on that, because one, the suppliers, or rather the buyers of that crude that have been rejected by Europe and the United States, might go to China. China would be a willing buyer, perhaps, but China's going to want to limit the exposure that it has to Russian oil. It doesn't want to be fully dependent on Russia, or even half dependent on Russia, because it sees its energy security is in having a diversity of suppliers. So probably the Russians would have to take a huge cut in the price that they would be willing to sell their crude at in order to sell it to China or to other places that might still be open markets.
Well, I know we have to leave it there with you. And Megan O'Sullivan, thank you for joining us on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be with you, and great to be with you, Nikos, as well.
Absolutely. And Nico Savo staying with us for the rest of the hour. We got a lot of comments coming in. Nico, here's a tweet from Darth, who says, since the U.S. is actually the world's leading oil producer, it is an issue of oil. Is it an issue of oil supply or an issue of lack of refineries in the United States? We both import oil, but we also export oil. Can the U.S. make up for whatever we don't get from Russia?
Yeah. That question is spot on. We are the largest producer of oil in the world. I wanted to maybe unpack that question in two different ways. One is there is an operational dimension to this. As Megan said, not all oil is the same. So we import different types of oil than what we export because we have a refining system where doing so makes sense. That is not a huge inconvenience, if I can use that word, for the U.S. oil system. The bigger question, the one that we really are trying to struggle with, is, you know, Russia exports about 8 million barrels of oil a day. Mm. The global market for oil is about 100. So when you're asking yourself, if I take 8 out of 100, where can I make up the 8? And as Megan said, you're not going to take out the 8 because they're going to sell it to China. They're going to be traders that come in. You're not going to get 8 to 0, but you're going to lose a big chunk of that. And so the question really is, you know, where can you find alternative supplies in order to make up the loss? And when you look around the world, the number one place where you can go get additional gas, additional oil, would be the United States. There are some challenges with that because it takes time, and there are some issues about the U.S. oil production system and the fact that for the last 10 years, the people that produced oil didn't make as much money as they wanted, and so investors are scared to invest. But when you look around the world, and if you say, if I have to live without Russian oil for the next 2-3 years, what is my number one line of defense in terms of bringing additional oil to the market? The answer is an unqualified, the United States.
Let me ask you about the price of gas at the pump. I mentioned it, and this is from AAA. This time last week, it was $3.62 a gallon. Now it's $4.17 a gallon. What explains a 50-cent a gallon increase at the pump? And I'm talking to people who are saying, look, I filled up my car and I had to pay $75. You know, someone making $40,000, $50,000 having to, you know, let's say drive for a living, an Uber driver or somebody like that, you know, how do people afford that? And what explains that huge jump in the price?
Look, there's no way to sugarcoat it. This is incredibly painful, especially we know for people with you know, fewer means, they spend a greater share of their income on energy, not just oil, electricity, natural gas. There's no way around recognizing that and understanding how painful it is. But let me go to the more analytical part of your question, which is, why is this happening?
Right.
And, you know, the price of oil is set in international markets by supply and demand. It, coming out of COVID, it has, the price of oil has risen because demand has been relatively strong. You know, people are driving again. They're maybe not taking as much public transportation. The economy was doing relatively okay, not just here, but in other parts of the world. So the price of oil had been increasing. It was about $90 a barrel at the international benchmark before this whole thing with Russia flared up. Now it's jumped to about 130, 140, depending on the day. Mm. And so you ask yourself, you know, why is this happening? And the main reason it's happening is what I alluded to before, which is folks are scared we might take out 5 to 8% of the global market. We might take out Russia from this big bathtub that Megan alluded to. So when you do the math, you realize, you know, 8 million barrels is a lot of oil. Just to give you a sense, you know, all the cars in the United States, all the cars consume about 8, 9, 10 million barrels a day. Mm. That's kind of the average, right? So you talk about taking out as much oil from the global market as all the cars use in the United States. So when people say, you know, why is this happening? Why have prices gone up so much? The very short answer is because we are faced with an energy shock of immense proportions, or at least we fear that the shock that we are experiencing could get much, much worse before it gets better.
Do you think there is, though, price gouging? That's something one of our listeners wanted to know. He says, James says, I know costs are up, but is there also price gouging going on? And you see, you know, depending on what gas station you go by, a huge range of prices when it comes to a gallon of gas.
Yeah, my very short answer to this is, look, we all have experience as consumers, and we see prices that don't make sense to us. And I'm not going to defend every price listed in every gas station across the United States, right? There are different reasons why prices may be up or down or higher or lower than their neighbor. What I will say is, if you step back a little bit and not talk about individual gas stations or individual moments in time, the price of gasoline tracks the price of oil very, very well, right? So I'm not saying that to absolve or to say that there's no price gouging or no anti-competitive behavior in different parts of the chain or at different moments or in different parts of the country. What I am saying is that if you take the price of oil and you plot it against the price of retail gasoline in the United States, those two curves look very close to one another, right? So I think we have to appreciate that what we're talking about when we're discussing, you know, price gouging or whatever, we're talking about, you know, cents on top of an overarching problem, right? We're talking about a plus or minus at the end of a very sharp increase that is driven by the price of oil.
Yeah. Here's a question from Rick, and I should just say that the members of the Biden administration were in Venezuela this weekend to talk to that country about, I guess, increasing its supply of oil. Rick says, we have plenty of oil reserves domestically and a lot of oil in Alaska. Why are we going to Venezuela? Nikos?
Yeah, that's a very fair question, and I think there are two answers to it. The very generous answer is to say, you know, if you're going to take out 5 to 8% of the global oil market, you need to go everywhere, right? There's just, you know, there isn't 5 million barrels a day of production capacity just sitting around waiting for us to press a button, right? So that's the generous explanation. I think the slightly less generous explanation is that, you know, this president was elected with a very strong agenda to take action on climate. He has been repeatedly vocal about the need for the U.S. energy system to change and to move towards other sources of energy and lower carbon sources of energy that don't emit as much carbon dioxide. And I think what you're experiencing is, you know, the difficulty of that administration to articulate a strategy for increasing oil production or even to call for any increase in oil production. They're really struggling to figure out how to do that and remain consistent to their climate goals. Mm-hmm. I happen to think that tension doesn't really exist. You know, we're at war. If we're going to lose Russian oil, everyone is paying for this. We have oil. Let's produce it. At the end of the day, we're just switching one oil for another. We're not doing that much worse for climate. I don't think there's a huge tension there. But you do feel that tension in the way that the administration is trying to manage this crisis.
Well, and picking up on that, I was thinking about that in preparation for the show about whether out of this crisis about what's happening in Ukraine and, of course, the role that Russia is playing, whether we will, you know, redouble our efforts to go into renewables so that we truly can be much more independent of crises around the world and dictators around the world, or whether we'll just deal so quickly with the emergency that we'll double down on fossil fuels. How do you're saying we can do both, or we're at a juncture here?
Well, I think you have an element of time and you have an element of space. So if you ask that question for Europe, there is absolutely an accelerated effort to get out of fossil fuels, to boost, you know, wind and solar and hydrogen and other technologies that we can rely on to reduce our dependence on oil, gas, and coal. So the European answer is incredibly clear. The U.S. answer, it's not obvious. No. We haven't heard the president really articulate that very clearly. He had an opportunity to do that at the State of the Union. He didn't, at least not in anywhere near the way that European leaders are articulating. What we do know is that energy crises, especially of this type, you know, lead to change. You know, after the Arab oil embargo, countries stepped up and built nuclear. They turned from oil to gas to coal. You know, we started investing in research and development. You know, we have a solar industry in part because of that effort. We invested in batteries. All these things that we enjoy today, most of them actually have their genesis in the aftermath of the oil embargo of 73. Mm. So these things change. Having said that, this is a massive system, and it takes a long time to change it. So what is really important is, while keeping an eye on the ball for 2030, you also have to make it through the next 12 months. And the strategy you need to make it through the next 12 months sometimes is the same, but sometimes it's different than the strategy you need to make it to 2030. And it is that disconnect that we are experiencing very acutely, especially in Washington, D.C.
We're almost having a break here, but how would that be articulated? What's a way to articulate that would make sense to the American public?
I think the way to articulate is to say, we need to get out of oil, but until we do, we need to produce as much oil as we can. Hmm. It doesn't seem to me incredibly difficult to say that. Look...
We can do both, you're saying? We can do both?
Well, here's the reality. You know, you have to drive to work this morning, right? If all the oil in the world disappears, you're stranded at home and you can't get to work. So until we get you a different way to get to work, getting rid of the oil doesn't save us, doesn't change anything. So you have to move things together on both the supply and the demand. So to say that, oh, we don't need oil because we want to go to electric vehicles, well, that's great. Until everyone has an electric vehicle, though, people are going to be stuck at home and can't drive. So we need to move both of these things together. And the reality is that right now, today, We cannot live without hydrocarbons. In the world, 80% of the energy comes from hydrocarbons. No matter how much we may dislike that number, we may wish it was lower, we may wish we could bring it down faster, this is the reality. So you have to deal with the world as it is, while also planning for the world that you want.
And we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Experts are warning that so-called strong men leaders are getting more and more popular. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is just the latest example of an authoritarian leader making a deadly call with little to no checks or balances. What happens when we shift away from democracy? And is there a way to shift back? Stopping the slide towards strongmen. Next time on 1A. Weekday mornings at 11 on WHYY.
Death is the one certainty, but we far too often avoid discussions about it. Now there's a growing movement to rethink end-of-life care in the United States, including how Black people are supported before and after death. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX. Weekdays at 2 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, People's Light, presents Personality, the Lloyd Price Musical. On stage in Malvern, March 9th through April 3rd, this world premiere musical tells the story of R&B sensation Lloyd Price, from humble beginnings to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Featuring hits like Laudie Miss Claudie, Stagger Lee, and the iconic song that gave Price the nickname Mr. Personality. For tickets, peopleslight.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Nico Savos. He is chair in energy and geopolitics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about President Biden's announcement yesterday banning all energy imports from Russia. We're talking about Russia's role as an energy provider, the political and environmental impact of energy dependence and, I guess, independence. Also plans to make up for the energy shortfall, the potential for renewables, whether this ban will hurt Putin's war effort. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Nico, so let me read a couple of comments or questions here from our listeners. Paul asks, last week, Russia was cut off from banks, financial markets, and the SWIFT system. How are they getting payments for their energy? Do you know?
Yeah, so we cut off some Russian banks, not all of them. And so what happens is the payments are going through the banks that remain. So we didn't sanction all the banks, primarily because we didn't want to totally choke off the exports of Russian energy. So we sanctioned some banks, and we sanctioned deliberately the banks that we thought were going to have the smallest impact in terms of the energy market. So that's how they're exporting the current energy. They're getting paid because there's still existing banks that can transact.
Here's an email from Eric. He says, I'm frustrated listening to your guests. Who cares about the economic logic? First of all, I don't buy products from someone who just killed my neighbor and is in the process of killing other neighbors, period. It's just that simple. The point of crushing the Russian economy is to make Russian people feel the pain and get upset with Putin. To put things in perspective, is it such a big deal to wear sweaters inside and turn down the thermostat from 70 degrees to 60 degrees as opposed to funneling money to Russia? I mean, obviously, Nikos, Biden and others, they're asking for a sacrifice. In war, people make sacrifices. Does that make sense to you?
I wholeheartedly appreciate the sentiment. You know, I grew up in Greece. It's not a very long drive to go from Greece to Ukraine. I'm feeling this very personally, so I very much sympathize with the sentiment. Having said that, I want to put two more ideas to this answer. One is, you know, you win wars by being smart. You're trying to figure out, how can I hurt them more than I hurt myself, right? And so I appreciate the logic of, if the Russian people get really desperate, they're going to take to the streets and they're going to topple this government. I understand that logic, but as a student of history, I can also tell you that that doesn't happen very often. And even if you lose Putin, you may get someone else who continues this war. So I want to win, but I want to be smart in how we win. I think that's one. The second thing that I would say, and this is more of a comment on Europe, is we are not just talking about, you know, putting on a sweater and, you know, driving, you know, two times rather than three times during the day. Mm-hmm. We are talking about shutting down, especially if we lose Russian gas, you know, shutting down the entire industrial sector of Europe. Right? The industrial sector of Europe primarily relies on natural gas. We're talking about factories that make anything from cars to pharmaceuticals and chemicals, fertilizers. You know, we're talking about not having enough gas to keep the lights on, having sort of rolling blackouts. I mean, we have seen even in this country, even you know, in really energy-rich places like Texas, what it means to not have energy even for brief periods of time. We talk about not being able to heat your houses. Not now, who cares? You know, now it's March, or we're sort of almost done with winter. But again, if we're trying to dig in for the long haul, we also have to think about how do we make it through next winter. And so what I'm trying to think through is, you know, if I'm in this war, like if I shut down like a third of European industry, like does that help me win the war or not, right? And I'm not sure that it does. So I totally appreciate, you know, the sentiment and the anger, and I, trust me, I share it times 10. I also want to win, and I want to figure out what the best way to win is. And right now, I'm not sure that imposing these costs on us is the best way to win. If he does it to us, we will survive. I mean, you know, you read histories of World War II and sacrifice, you know, people are going to step up and they're going to do things. But let's be honest about what that looks like, right? It's a war with, you know, a nuclear superpower with a massive military on the borders of Europe, right? So trying to think through the steps, I don't think is an imprudent way to engage this conflict.
I played a bit of a speech that Ronald Reagan gave, kind of chastising Europe, I guess, and maybe the United States by association for its dependence on Russia for fuel, for fossil fuels. Marie tweets, Reagan set us back decades by taking the solar panels installed by Carter from the White House. So, I mean, I don't want to say that Ronald Reagan, you know, he certainly wasn't pure when it came to this issue. We played that clip because I just thought it was an interesting analysis as we still struggle with this relationship with Russia. Question from John, is there any oversight to these sanctions? Can Russia just relabel their oil and sell it in a different way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Sorry, let me begin again.
That's okay.
They can, but we're on to them, right? So a lot of what Iran did when we imposed sanctions on Iran is they tried to switch tankers halfway on this, out of the sea, and they try to change the name of the tankers, and they try to send it to a third country, and then you're importing from a third country, you're not longer importing from Iran. The point is that these are not new tricks. We have satellites, we have transponders, we know who we're transacting with. So especially if we impose harsher sanctions on Russia, they will absolutely do that. But it's not like we don't expect them to do that. We can still enforce it. And especially if we have the Europeans on our side, the enforcement mechanism becomes much easier because we just have more eyes on what the Russians are doing. The final thing I'll say to that is the Russians also export a lot of their oil through pipelines that go straight to Europe.
Right.
Right. And so it's one thing to say, you know, I put oil in a ship in, you know, the Baltic Sea, and I try to sort of, you know, do a trick so no one notices it's a Russian ship. It's much harder to do with the exports that are coming through the hard-wired infrastructure that supply, you know, European refineries. So there are also limits physically, in addition to limits in terms of our enforcement of those sanctions, there are limits physically to how much Russia could just reroute that oil elsewhere.
Here's a tweet from A. Feldman, and picking up on what we were talking about earlier, he says the world will not be safe as long as we depend on fossil fuels. We're vulnerable to the whims of autocrats, massive corporations, and multi-billionaires until we transition. The best time to put a price on carbon was 10 years ago. Second best is now. What do you think of that, a price on carbon?
You know, I'm a trained economist, and so my answer is the price on carbon is a no-brainer, but is also not politically feasible right now. So in terms of, you know, do I agree that it would be great to have a price on carbon? Absolutely. Do I agree that, you know, much as the cost of the pump is painful for consumers, the reality is that in this country, we don't really tax energy very much. You know, my favorite data point is we first introduced a federal tax on gasoline in 1932 at 1 cent a gallon. If you take that 1 cent and you adjust it for inflation, it's about 19 cents. Our current federal tax on gasoline is 18.4. Hmm. So we taxed gasoline in 1932 more than we taxed gasoline in 2022, right? So it's not just a carbon tax. It's more broadly, how do we tax gasoline and how do we tax energy? Because if you don't tax it, the price is very low and we overconsume. So I absolutely agree that this is part of the response, but I also want to be honest. Europe has a very high carbon price. It's helping accelerate the transition, but it's not the only thing. You still need to do everything else, invest, research and development, change markets, if you want to get rid of our dependence on fossil fuels.
I was thinking of the oil embargo. I remember in the 1970s standing in line to, you know, get some gas for my car. Are we more dependent on oil today than we were back in the 70s or less?
We are less dependent on oil if you look at it by the two measures that usually people look at it, which is how much of your energy comes from oil. That's sort of one way to measure it. And that actually is at a, you know, I don't remember the exact years, maybe like 50, 60, 70 year low in terms of like how much of our total energy comes from oil in the United States. The other way to measure it is how much oil do you need to produce a unit of GDP, you know, $1 million of GDP or $1 billion of GDP or whatever. And that too has been declining continuously in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. So by both of those measures, we are the least dependent on oil than we've ever been. But again, that doesn't say much because we're still highly dependent on oil, and in particular, in the transportation sector, right? Our transportation sector essentially runs on oil and on, you know, biofuels, on corn, on ethanol, with a very limited amount of electricity. That is the reality of our transportation system today. We're trying to change it, but again, there are, you know, 250 some million cars in the United States, and we only sell about 15 million cars a year. So even if tomorrow everyone started to only buy electric vehicles, and by the way, we don't have 15 million electric vehicles to sell you, but even if you assume that, it will still take 10, 15, 20 years for the whole fleet to turn over. That is the reality of the scale that we're dealing with.
People that want an e-vehicle, electric vehicle, are waiting and waiting and waiting because they're not available.
Exactly. So, you know, that's the reality, is that even if you want to switch, your ability to switch depends on someone making the product that you want at a competitive price and make it available to you. And that takes time. You know, we don't just, you know, press a button and have electric vehicles appear.
One of our listeners said, you know, said, put on a sweater and lower your thermostat. But I wonder whether if we focus more on efficiency, whether in our buildings or in our vehicles, whether that would help to reduce our dependence on fossil fuel and some of these more dangerous countries.
Absolutely. I mean, efficiency is the no-brainer. You know, I sometimes find myself here in Washington, D.C., wearing a sweater in the summer because it's so cold in my office building.
Exactly.
And, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to me, but this is the country that we have. And so there are huge potentials for efficiency, huge potential. I mean, if you look at, you know, we consume almost twice as much energy as the average European, right? So, you know, we consume more energy in our transportation sector than entire countries use to run everything. Huge potentials for efficiency. But if I can be a little bit unpleasant, let's also talk about what efficiency means. Efficiency means maybe not buying the brand new, you know, pickup truck and SUV, right? Because that's not the most efficient way to move around, right? So I think we have to recognize also the limits of efficiency when they clash with other objectives of other industrial sectors in the United States. So I absolutely endorse efficiency is the lowest hanging fruit, it somehow never is able to feed us as much as we would like it to. But let's also understand what efficiency means, which is sometimes changing what people are doing in ways that they may not appreciate is efficiency.
How would you define, we talk about being energy independent. As someone in your position, how do you see that? How do we define that? What does that look like?
Yeah, so in successive administrations, the United States has defined energy independence. Actually, it hasn't really defined energy independence. It's just a goal that we like to have because you know, who doesn't like independence,
sure,
right?
I mean, it's a powerful word.
Exactly. Who's anti-independence? The way that you usually measure this is to try to figure out whether you import a lot of energy, right? And by that measure, you know, we have actually become a net exporter of energy. We export more energy than we import. It's not true across all energy sources, so we still are net importers of oil, but we're net exporters of natural gas and coal. But on average, we actually export more energy to the world than we import from the world. And historically, that has been the goal. The goal has been to lower imports, to become more self-sufficient. What it hasn't done is because we still trade with the rest of the world, because it is still one big bathtub, to use Megan's analogy, it means that you're still subject to all the shocks in the world. What happens in Russia affects you because you're part of one global market, because even if you don't trade with Russia, the people that you buy oil from or sell oil to trade with Russia. And so if they change their behavior, that affects you. So I think the promise of energy independence as a way to insulate the American consumer and the American economy from global energy shocks, that has been a mirage. We've known that it's a mirage. I mean, the politicians don't say it, but we've known, as analysts, we know that this is nonsense as a goal for the better part of 40 years, right? So it's not a surprise to us that being a massive producer has not insulated us from international energy shocks. We've known this for a long time. The real question is dependence or independence, you know, you have to put that in a broader context. You know, let me give you a sad example very quickly. You know,
very quickly, because we've got about 30 seconds, but go ahead.
Texas is independent in its electricity grid. That means that when it needed to trade with its neighbors, it couldn't. So independence sometimes means also isolation. And resilience comes from connectivity. And so we should focus on resilience and adaptation and ability to manage, not just independence.
Well, Nico Savos, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's the James R. Schlesinger Chair in Energy and Geopolitics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you for joining us. And I'd like you to join me for a virtual conversation with Ken Burns, Walter Isaacson, and Erica Dunbar. This is about Ken Burns' new film called Benjamin Franklin. And it is a virtual event, and it is March 29th at 7 o'clock at night. And for information about tickets, how to sign up, how to go to whyy.org/Franklin. Hope to see you there.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania. Do you drink more than you want to? Do you drink mainly for the rewarding effects of alcohol? Doctors at UPenn are conducting a research study of a medication that may help people reduce or stop their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and want to reduce or stop your drinking. The study provides a medical evaluation, blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-746-1987.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.